Should I just buy the really expensive one because it's going to be the best?
No, food costs do not correlate with quality necessarily.
Hello, and welcome to today's episode of Vetrospective. This is Dr. Michael Kent, a professor from the UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine, and your host. Dog food. Dog food and nutrition. What at first seems so simple can actually be a pretty complex topic. In my mind, what it boils down to, though, is what should I feed my dog? Yes, and I do have a dog. So this is so fundamental to your dog's life. Dog food and treats is also a huge industry. A quick Google search I did the other day showed me that the US market alone is valued at $65 billion a year. It's a huge number. So this, combined with a lot of misinformation floating around out there, a lot coming from really well-meaning people and places, means how do we sort this all out? Should I feed kibble or wet, commercial or home-cooked? What about diet trends? Should I feed grain-free diets or raw or low-carbohydrate foods? It can get overwhelming. So to try to help us sort all this out, I have asked Dr. Jennifer Larson to join us here today. So Dr. Larson earned her PhD in nutritional biology and her DVM from UC Davis. She is a board certified veterinary specialist in nutrition, and she's also service chief of the nutrition service here at the hospital. She provides clinical nutritional consulting and is director of an amino acid laboratory, mentors residents and students, and teaches in our veterinary curriculum, as well as for a graduate group. So before we dive into these questions, I'm going to ask you something I ask a lot of our guests. Why'd you become a veterinarian, and why nutrition?
Those are great questions. Thank you, Dr. Kent. I'm so happy to be here.
Thank you.
I became a veterinarian essentially to do exactly what I'm doing now. I was not one of those people that wanted to be a veterinarian for a long period of time because I was pretty ignorant about what that meant. So I thought veterinarians essentially gave vaccines and did spays and neuters, and that was pretty much the extent of my knowledge of what that involved.
Fair.
And so once I came to UC Davis as an undergraduate and then went on to do graduate work and master's and started my PhD, I was working as a work study student, which is one of the financial support mechanisms we have on main campus. And that gave me the opportunity to work in some research labs alongside veterinarians that were training to be specialists and that were doing research to support their advanced training. And that really sparked my interest in the field and opened my eyes to what was possible. And I thought, this is more like what I want to do. So I actually didn't even apply to veterinary school until I was partly through my PhD program and then ended up doing those concurrently and ultimately went to college for 18 years.
18 years. I don't even want to count how long I went to college. And I joke that I've never left.
Yeah,
you
we
stay
like
at the
academy.
University. I go to school. I don't go to work,
yep.
You know, but so really, you kind of came to clinical medicine starting at research. So that gives you an interesting perspective, huh?
Yeah, I like being curious about things. I like learning things. And I feel that the more that I know and the further along I get in my career, not only am I hyper-specialized like a lot of us here at the university, but we have the ability to just text somebody or walk down the hallway and ask a question about something. And being around emerging knowledge and people that know a lot about something else is great. It's the environment that I think a lot of us thrive in.
Yeah. So this is pretty interesting, but we could maybe do a podcast on that, but I'm going to go back to feeding your dog. You know, this is something that, like I said, is so fundamental. So the simplest way that I think about it is I go buy a bag of dog food, either at the grocery store or the box store or off the internet. But how do I tell if it's good? Like, there are thousands of different brands. Like we said, this is a multi-billion dollar industry. So where do I even start?
Yeah, that's a big question, and we get that question all the time. There's so many different marketing categories, and then within those marketing categories, different forms
So
of
marketing,
food.
marketing. So just explain that to me also. Marketing versus nutrition. We're talking
Yeah.
about nutrition, not marketing.
Yeah, I mean, dog food, dog treats, pet supplies, that it's a huge marketing category, and there's a lot of purchasing power in the consumers that own dogs and cats, and a lot of people increasingly want to treat them like family. And so marketing is a strategy that's used to essentially sell you an idea or a product, separate you from your money in some one way or another. And it's an entire discipline unto itself. But it's pretty well established that the same sorts of marketing strategies and techniques that are used to sell parents things for their children are used to sell pet supplies, pet food, pet treats to pet
So
owners.
how do I make sure I'm not giving them the high sugar breakfast cereal and I'm giving them good nutrition, because that's important, obviously.
Yeah, nutrition is fundamental to maintaining health, prevention and treatment of disease, and that's what we do every day. And I love talking about food, but it is really more than
I love
food.
eating
It's
it.
it's the experience of eating it is very important too for us and for our pets. But the nutrients themselves also have an important role here, and how we deliver those nutrients can differ from food to food and from individual to individual. And so I think that a lot of people try to take some of the ideas from human nutrition and apply it to animal nutrition. And some of those are transferable, and that's reasonable. And in other cases, it doesn't really work. Like the schemes that we use in human nutrition don't really work for pet nutrition. A lot of times when we're feeding our pets, we're feeding complete and balanced diets, which we really only employ for ourselves when it really matters, right? Like that's what baby formula is, milk replacers, when we send people to space or in the ICU or they're soldiers out in harsh environments. That's when we use complete and balanced diets. But otherwise, if you're just a normal, healthy human or even managing a chronic disease, we sort of rely on people to make those choices for themselves every day.
Yeah, because sometimes I don't have veggies in the fridge, and I might make a less balanced meal, but then the next one I'll make up for it. Is that's what you kind of mean?
Yeah, and I think people feel like they're pretty good at balancing out their diets and eating a wide variety, but from a population perspective, we're actually not that good at that. And that's why so much of our food is enriched or fortified. So rice is fortified, lots of cereals, certain dairy products that are lower in fat have to have vitamins A and D, et cetera.
Or why we put iodine in our salt.
Right. So those are sort of population-based approaches to solve common gaps in what we're getting nutritionally.
So I'm still wondering, Dr. Larson, where we fit this in. Why can't I just go and get some salmon, get some rice, maybe throw in a tablespoon of corn oil because I know we need some fatty acids. And cut up some broccoli and that should be enough for the dog, right? Or, and if I feed that, isn't that going to be sufficient to really maintain their life and give them good quality of food?
Well, we have to consider that dogs require about 40 essential nutrients,
40.
and they all have to be present in very precise amounts and ratios to each other and in a form that their body can actually use. And so, in my opinion, the best use and the biggest advantage of a home-cooked diet is our ability to customize it. And so, as I'm sure all of your listeners are aware, dogs are the most diverse species in terms of size. We have everything from Chihuahuas to Great Danes and extremes on both of those ends. That is a huge difference in body size. And so making sure that they're eating enough calories from each of the different components in their diet, that we are supplementing their diet appropriately so that we're making sure that all of the essential vitamins and minerals and amino acids and so forth are all
Those
added are really important.
are those 40 nutritional items you're talking
Yeah,
about.
there's fatty acids, there's amino acids, vitamins, minerals, there's some vitamin-like substances as we refer to them. It's really important that they're all present in appropriate amounts.
Now, I'm gonna fess up here. I don't feed my dog anything home cooked, but if we wanted to put that in, we could think about that 10% as a topper thing, right? That might be a nice way to supplement it.
Yeah, I think a lot of people like to do that. And that's a fine way to offer variety. A lot of dogs like fruits and vegetables, and they especially like things like meat and peanut butter. And
oh, anything that hits the floor, my dog eats. And, you know, that's when
retrievers aren't known for their pickiness necessarily.
So that's another thing. I feed my dog a Labrador Retriever food. What? Why is there a Labrador Retriever food? Now, he likes it, and I'm like, great. But he also likes anything. So I've obviously fallen for marketing, or is there something that's different than the Golden Retriever food from the... And I know there is, because once there wasn't Labrador Retriever food, and I bought Golden Retriever food.
Yeah, there's lots of different breed-specific diets for different breeds of dogs and cats. Some of that is marketing, and some of it is based in science and actual, like, firm foundations for doing that. So, for example, the diets that are designed for the animals that have sort of more of a round skull, those brachycephalic dogs and cats, so bulldogs and Persians.
The smushed-faced dogs
yes,
we love so much.
Short-muzzled dogs and cats.
I used to have a pug.
Those kibbles are designed to be a specific shape and texture that makes it easier for them to pick up so that they can get the food into their mouth and chew it more appropriately. The diet that you feed your dog is meant to not have a lot of calories for its weight, to be a little bit more diluted out to prevent the weight gain. As you know, retrievers tend to never believe that they're full, and they love to overeat, and overweight is a big problem for them.
I've timed my dog eating 47 seconds. That's his average. So he eats his food in 47 seconds.
And sometimes shorter.
Sometimes shorter if we let them. But yeah, no, I get it. So I've done it again and gone down a rabbit hole with you, but I want to bring us back to the grocery store. I picked up a bag. I'm looking at the label. I'm going to ignore the marketing because you warned me about that already, right?
That's hard to do.
Yeah, I know. I'm a sucker for it.
Everybody is.
Yeah. Okay, I'm looking at the label. What's on the label and what should I be looking for?
So the most important part of the label can actually be a very difficult thing to find, and it's referred to as the nutritional adequacy statement.
So is this kind of what's on my food when I go and buy something there? Is there anything like that on the human food? Or are we looking for something different?
Yeah, we're looking for something different. So human food is not meant to be the sole source of nutrition for people, but complete and balanced pet foods are intended to be the sole source of nutrition, or they can be fed that way. Mm-hmm. Treats are an exception, and there are some unbalanced foods that aren't intended to be fed every single day as the sole source of nutrition. So the nutritional adequacy statement is required to be on pet foods that are not specifically labeled as a snack or a treat. And it tells you three really important pieces of information. It tells you whether the product has a complete and balanced claim, and that is a legal definition, it's a claim. Secondly, it tells you how that claim was substantiated, and I'll get back to that in a second.
Perfect, because I need to know that.
The third thing that it tells you is the species and the life stage for which the diet is intended. And so the life stage categories for dog and cat food are during growth, so for puppies or kittens, adults, and then reproduction. There's also an overarching category called all life stages that can mm-hmm. be fed to animals in all life stages. So whether you're growing, adult, etc. But there isn't a separate category for things like seniors, disease management, etc. So any claims for those uses are going to essentially fall under marketing, and they might differ depending on the company's philosophy.
Okay. So you were going to come back to something.
The substantiation.
Big word. So how do we substantiate this?
Yeah. So what that essentially just means is that the company is making a statement that their food is complete and balanced for growth of kittens or maintenance of adult dogs or something like that. So it's a species and life stage specific claim. That claim has to be based on the food being formulated to meet a specific nutrient profile, which is a regulatory guideline.
Okay.
Or the food can go through a feeding test being fed to animals that are in that specific life stage. And then there's certain testing done to make sure that the diet is supporting them adequately.
So which is better? Like, if it says that it's formulated, is that good enough, or should it have gone through the trial you talked about?
Like so much in nutrition, the answer is going to be it depends.
Yeah.
So there are pros and cons to both of those methods, but ideally, a company would be formulating a diet to meet some nutritional standard to have a target profile, and then they would be doing some sort of testing in an animal to make sure that the nutrients are bioavailable, et cetera. Because just because it looks good on paper doesn't mean that it's going to perform well in the animal.
Bioavailable. Now, what do you mean in terms of nutrition? I know what meaning bioavailable means your body can actually absorb it and use it, but why is that an issue?
Yeah, that's an issue because if you analyze a specific food for specific nutrient profile in a laboratory, you're essentially figuring out how much of that nutrient is present in that food.
Okay, how much calcium is located in a cup of dog food?
Right,
Okay.
exactly. So you could do a chemical analysis, you could figure out that value,
Yeah.
how many grams of calcium are in this cup of dog food. But how much your dog is actually absorbing and using is a different number because it's not going to be 100%. And calcium actually isn't that available depending on the form. Maybe you're absorbing 30% of it. And so those numbers are pretty well defined, but understanding how that specific food performs in a specific animal is really, really important.
And do you think we know what the nutritional requirements of dogs are? Is that pretty well established now over time?
It's pretty well established for the typical foods that we are using in dogs. Now, there is some caution to that statement because we are often using data from specific situations and applying it to other situations. And so
As
we're,
we do with everything in life.
yes, of
Yeah.
course. Yep. And so we're learning more and more about other compounds that might be considered essential under certain circumstances, or maybe there's an interaction between nutrients, or maybe under a disease state. So there's always more to learn, but we have the basics down pretty well.
So I'm going to bring you back to the grocery store again. I'm standing with this bag here and I'm finding the nutritional adequacy statement. And what am I looking for exactly? What's going to be written there to tell me it's okay to buy this bag of dog food?
Yeah, so you want to think about the pet that you have at home. So, do you have a growing puppy? Do you have an adult dog that doesn't have any health problems? Or maybe your vet has sent you to the store to look for a specific kind or type of food. And so, you're keeping those things in mind. If you have a healthy adult dog, as you mentioned already, there are thousands of different appropriate options. So you're essentially looking for a dog food that has a complete and balanced claim to cover the needs of adult dogs.
Okay. And is there a specific wording I should be looking for?
It'll say something like this diet is formulated to meet the dog nutrient profiles, or animal feeding tests substantiate that this product supports this life stage.
Okay. And I'm now thinking, like, I see this bag and it costs $70. This bag costs $90. This bag costs $110. Should I just buy the 110? Because you actually, full disclosure, Dr. Larson knows me quite well. Jen is my good friend. She knows my dog. So should I just buy the really expensive one because it's going to be the best?
No, food costs do not correlate with quality necessarily. There's so much that goes into how much a food costs. Some of it is the volume that the company is selling, what kind of outlets they're selling it through. Is it only online? Is it only through specialty stores? Are they selling it through grocery stores, et cetera? And then the size of the bag. So a bigger bag is going to cost less per pound than a smaller bag. There's also factors like, is it a diet that needs to be refrigerated or frozen? Is it a canned diet? Those are way more expensive. So in general, if we want to think about the kinds of diets that are available out there, a kibble diet is by far the most popular. It's the most commonly used, and it's the most cost-effective. Partly that's because it's dry, so you're not paying for water and
And
for
you're not
shipping
shipping
water.
water or preserving
And the
water.
packaging is much less expensive as
Yeah,
well.
that makes sense. So, should I be feeding any of these refrigerated foods then if they're better? Are they necessarily any better? Or they look fresher. I see them. I see people bring them in.
Yeah, people really like the idea of having a quote unquote fresh diet. And there's lots of these homemade style commercial diets out there, and they're very aggressively marketed. I think all of us that are on social media have gotten ads for those. We don't have any proof that they're better, and they're certainly going to be way more expensive. There are also concerns about nutritional sustainability in terms of the types of ingredients that we put in those foods. A lot of them are claiming to be human grade, which has a definition that essentially just describes a process. It doesn't differentiate nutritional value or quality.
So human grade, meaning it's what I go and buy at the grocery store.
Yeah, it's essentially a food that is competing with the human food chain for those same things. And that sounds good. Like people like that. That word definitely has a health halo, but it's meaningless in terms of quality and nutritional value. And that's because it's just a regulation term about who is in charge of regulating those specific ingredients. If you consider animals, where we're getting a lot of our nutrients from for ourselves and for our pets, there are plenty of parts of an animal that humans can't or won't eat, right?
Yeah, we either decide that it's not socially acceptable to eat this part of it, or we're vegetarian, so we don't eat any of it, but yes.
Right. Yeah. And I mean, to be fair, the differences in what we consider food among the things that are edible is
Yes.
arbitrary. There are generational differences, there are cultural differences, there are economic differences.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people don't eat organs the way that we used to. Like our grandparents all ate organs, right? And lots of cultures, organs are very popular still, but there's a huge,
Chopped liver,
yes,
right?
right, liver and onions for Sunday dinner.
We didn't have liver and onions, but I loved chopped liver growing up.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And
Anyway.
organs are very palatable for dogs and cats too, and they have a lot more nutritional value than muscle meat.
Okay, so let's say I go into the store and I go, you know what? This is confusing. I'm just going to cook for my dog. I'm just going to feed my dog what I eat at every meal. Is that an acceptable way to feed your dog?
Yeah, a lot of people are very interested in home cooking for their pets. And formulating homemade diets is something that I spend a lot of my professional career doing. Most of the time, that's because there's a medical need for that, meaning that the patients that we're managing have a combination of diseases where there isn't a suitable therapeutic diet. Or the pet has decided that the available therapeutic diets are a no.
I.e., they don't taste good to them.
Yes, either because of the underlying disease or the medications that we're giving. We do a lot of things in the treatment and management of disease that affect appetite and sensory aspects of liking and choosing to consume food.
Taste.
Yes, of course.
Or smell with dogs also, right? Smell is going to
Absolutely.
be really important for dogs.
Yeah.
Sometimes the worse smell, the better.
Yes, we're not always aligned with what smells and tastes
So
good.
let's say I want to feed my dog and I have my oatmeal or toast for breakfast, and then for lunch I had some of last night's dinner, and then I just split my meal with him. Is that an okay way to go?
Well, small amounts of table foods are fine.
No, I mean if we're just going to feed him like that.
Yeah, so that wouldn't be a balanced diet.
Okay.
So our general guideline is that we don't want more than 10% of the calories to be coming from an unbalanced source. Now, that could be table foods that you're sharing, that could be dog treats, toppers that you're adding to the diet. There's even a lot of calorie-containing supplements, like fish oil, for example,
I was
is
going to ask you about that later, so we'll get there.
Yeah, I mean, oils are fat and they provide a lot of calories, but they don't provide the full complement of the 40-ish essential nutrients that dogs require. And so it's really important that we're feeding a balanced diet. So when I'm formulating a home-cooked diet that is balanced, I'm making sure that I'm providing supplements to sort of fill in the gaps between what's coming from the base ingredients, so the protein and the fiber source, the fat source, et cetera, and what the animal needs. So that's going to require, if I'm using human supplement products, between 4 and 8 different products. You can't just chuck in a multivitamin and consider it balanced. So there's a lot to consider. And as you know, we've done some work looking at homemade diet recipes. And a lot of that has been supported by the school's Center for Companion Animal Health. And so we've done quite a few studies looking at the recipes that our clients have access to because we were seeing so many people use them and we were pretty concerned about that.
So why were you concerned about them? What, like, they're coming from reputable sources, I suppose, either veterinarians or, you find them on the internet. But aren't they good at supporting life? I mean, can't you just formulate a recipe?
Yeah, I think that a lot of people think it's pretty easy. You just mix foods or you can just use a ratio.
I'll just go get hamburger at the store and I seriously, so enlighten me, Dr. Larson,
Yeah.
please.
A lot of those recipes are pretty vague. So maybe they say 2 cups of chicken. Okay, is that light meat? Is that dark meat? Is it thigh, breast? Does it include the bone and the skin? Does it not include the bone and the skin? Is that the raw amount? Is that the cooked amount? How are you cooking it? If you cook it, are you including the drippings or are you discarding the drippings? So, as you can imagine, once you start thinking through all of those details, there's a lot of different factors that can change what ultimately ends up in the bowl. So, the vague parts of recipes were pretty concerning to us. They were also clearly missing sources of important essential nutrients, like there wasn't a source of calcium. And so we looked at this in pretty systematically in a few studies. We looked at 200 dog recipes in one study. We looked at almost 100 cat recipes in another study. And we found by far very, very few of the recipes that are available online or in books, even if they're written by veterinarians or are in veterinary textbooks, have enough problems that we don't recommend sort of those general or generic recipes.
So you mean that they're missing a key nutrient, a key enzyme, a key something that's not going to support life on its own?
Yeah, at least one.
At least one.
Yeah, so the study that we did when we looked at 200 dog recipes, we found that about 83% of those were missing more than one essential nutrient.
Wow, that's pretty impactful.
Yeah.
All right, you've convinced me I shouldn't be cooking for my dog. I should really stick with the dog food that's available, commercial dog food. Just me. I mean, some people want to do that and that's okay. But it sounds like they should speak to a veterinary nutritionist before they do. So call for help, right?
Yes, that's what we're here for. We're happy to help guide people that want to or considering cooking for their pets.
Okay, so maybe we'll put the link in the summary for this episode so they can figure out how they can either talk to you or have their veterinarians request counsel. Okay, I'm back in the dog food aisle. I'm reading this. I see there's a nutritional summary statement and I'm happy with it. I see an ingredient list. Who's controlling all this? Who regulates it? Again, I'm a little skeptical because this is, like I said, this is a multi-billion dollar industry.
Pet food is actually pretty highly regulated, especially compared to human food. I think people really don't appreciate the levels of regulation that are going on. So there is some regulation going on at the federal level from the FDA.
Oh, so the Food and Drug Administration, who controls everything from drugs to meat and everything. Well, that's agriculture, but still, it covers a lot of the food we eat, also covers pet food.
Yeah, absolutely. There are lots of veterinarians that work for the FDA. And as far as pet food goes, their main interests are making sure that pet food is truthfully labeled, so consumer protection in terms of understanding what they're buying, that it's not contaminated with harmful substances. And so the FDA does
Good.
have the power to pressure companies to do a voluntary recall. They also have the power to do a mandatory recall. So they will respond to complaints. They do have a laboratory network to sort of investigate contaminants and consumer complaints. There's a portal where you can report problems. And then they also have rules related to processing, safe processing temperature of canning and those kinds of things. The majority of the regulation, though, is going on at the state level. And that's where AAFCO comes into play. So some people may have heard the term AAFCO.
AFCO, can you tell me what that means?
Yes, that stands for the Association of American Feed Control Officials. Now, AAFCO is not a regulatory body themselves. They are an advisory body, but their members are made up of a lot of the state feed control officials. So every state has their own feed control unit at the level of the state government. So in California, we're the CDFA, the California Department of Food and Ag.
And that would cover everything from dogs to cats to horses to cattle to even, you know, all the food production animals.
Yeah, all the animal foods. And as you can imagine, there is a lot more focus on livestock in terms of it being a food supply for people and making sure that there aren't drug residues and those kinds of infectious diseases and those kinds of problems. But so pet food is still regulated at the state level. And so the state feed control officials then will look at what AFCO is presenting in terms of model feed laws. Mm-hmm. And so what that means is that every year AFCO publishes a book called The Official Publication, and that book has model feed laws in it. And those laws include everything from the nutritional profiles that the diets have to meet to in order to say that they're okay for growth or for adults or reproducing animals. They have ingredient definitions. So if a food doesn't have an ingredient definition, you can't put it into an animal diet.
Okay, so that helps ensure that it's safe, at least.
Yeah, there are definitely definitions for what's allowed to be in pet food and what's not allowed to be in pet food.
Yeah, so you're not like putting melamine in there or something like that as a filler to look like there's more protein than there is.
Yeah, and there's a big focus on avoiding drug residues, of course, either antibiotics or euthanasia drugs and those kinds of things. There's a zero tolerance policy for those contaminants.
And obviously for pet foods, that's really essential too.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So we think they're pretty safe and we think they're fairly well regulated. You know, it's really down to then preferences if you want to feed a wet or a dry, if you want to feed one of these refrigerated foods, as long as they've got the nutritional labels on there saying, you know, and it sounds to me like you're going to go pretty well as long as the food's labeled correctly. Are the labels enforced? Do people check them?
Yeah, so that's a good question. A lot of the regulation, which is done at the federal and state level, is then sort of left up to like the local officials to monitor and enforce. However, so much of the responsibility and that onus to make sure that companies are making safe and healthful pet foods and that they're meeting their claims comes down to the manufacturers themselves. So they have a huge responsibility. It's really important that they have the expertise and the money to engage in a lot of involved quality control, research and development, and all of those other aspects of having a pet food that is safe. So that's why we recommend buying pet food that is made by a large, experienced manufacturer, just like when you buy a car or a dishwasher or anything else.
So it sounds like it's a lot of self-regulation too.
And they're testing each other's foods all the time.
Okay. So that's why you're suggesting that maybe one of the more established companies may be safer than a small boutique one, which may not either have the expertise or may not do the testing they're supposed to.
Yeah, they might not even know what's important. So that the level of expertise is really important. You want to have formulation experts, legal experts, toxicology experts, processing experts on your team, and they should be employees of your company so that you know that you're making a safe and nutritious pet food.
Hmm. So it's all very interesting. And again, it makes it a little bit more complex, right? This is a lot to think about when you're making a diet that's going to be 100% of their nutrition.
Yeah. And unfortunately, there isn't a lot of transparency in the pet food industry because it's so competitive. Companies are pretty, secretive about some of the palatants they use to make their food taste good. You know, they want to have that competitive advantage and those kinds of things.
I mean,
right?
That happens in human food too, right?
Absolutely.
You know, the secret formula for a drink or something.
Right. Or the 11 herbs and spices or, you know, all those things. And so I think that consumers can get sort of lost and they don't understand, how do I look at information and decide, is this just marketing or is this something that's actually useful information? And you're really relying on the reputation of the company. And that's why marketing and the way that marketing interacts with the way our brains work psychologically is such an important part of making decisions about pet food purchasing.
And I know we're going to run out of time, but over the years, I've seen a number of fads in pet food diets, dog food particular, and people too also, right? Okay, first, raw. I know it's controversial. I've heard the argument that this is what wild dogs and wolves eat. So is it safe? Is it better nutritionally? But enlighten me, Dr. Larson, enlighten me.
There are a lot of aspects to that. So the fact of the matter is that dogs did not evolve as hunters. They evolved as scavengers. So dogs have lived alongside people for thousands and thousands of years. The vast majority of the dogs in the world today still live the way dogs evolved, where they're sort of loosely associated with human settlements. They live off our handouts, our garbage dumps, et cetera. They are very good at fulfilling that niche. In fact, they are out competing some wild canids in some areas, like the Ethiopian wolf is endangered. Dogs are doing very well in that specific setting. And so I think people have this naturalistic appeal to that idea that it is natural, but we don't actually want natural when it comes to our lives or our pets' lives.
Why? You know, like, isn't a wolf going to be very similar to my dog? This is my softball question to you, you know.
Yeah, wolves and dogs are pretty similar, and we share a lot of the same DNA, just like we do with bonobos and chimpanzees, right? Mm-hmm. But our goals for our pets are longevity. We want them to live well into their late teens and beyond, if possible, right? And
yes,
lifespans for people and for dogs have been lengthening and lengthening over time because of preventative medicine, infectious disease control, better nutrition, et cetera. From an evolutionary perspective, what would be natural would be to reproduce as early as possible and then make offspring that are better than you for the environment that you're in. And then ideally you would die and get out of the way and stop competing for resources.
I don't want my dog going away anytime soon.
That's not what we want for our pets. A lot of people don't want their pets to reproduce, which is probably a good thing. We want them to live a long period of time. We want them to be healthy. So our goals are decidedly not natural for our pets. And that's okay.
So natural raw food, where's the problem with this?
Yeah. So the other thing about raw diets is, are they beneficial? Right. Yeah. So I think that if we thought about it critically, we could agree that they're not natural in a lot of ways. But in terms of them being beneficial, there is no evidence that raw diets are of any benefit. And any benefit that somebody sees when they're using a raw diet is not related to the fact that the meat is raw.
It's often not a better coat. It's not
right.
These things that people attribute it to.
Yeah, those are related to the diet is higher in fat, probably. So that's why the coat looks so great, right? The diet doesn't have a lot of fiber. That's why the stools are smaller. A lot of owners like that they can identify what's in the diet. And that's just because they're afraid of ingredients because of fear-mongering type marketing.
So it looks like meat. It looks like carrots are in
there.
Yeah.
And so the fact that we don't have any specific benefits related to the rawness of the diet per se, we contrast that with the flip side of that coin, which is that we do have some concerns. So a lot of raw diets are not balanced, and that goes for home-prepared raw diets as well as some commercial diets. There are some balanced commercial raw diets, but there are also lots of companies that make raw diets without a complete and balanced claim, and they're sort of aiming for a rotational strategy or not making any claim about how to achieve a raw diet whatsoever. So that's a concern, but that's something that's easy to fix. Balancing the diet is not hard.
We just need a veterinary nutritionist.
Right.
Yes.
You need somebody on your commercial team or that's formulating a home-prepared diet to balance it. It's not that hard. The harder part is pathogen control. So there's a reason why we don't eat raw meat, right? Sushi accepted, but there
Or
are,
steak tartare if you fall
yes.
into that category, right?
But there's still, you know, for sushi grade fish, it has to be frozen at a certain temperature to control pathogens. Like there's still processes. And so for raw pet foods and for raw meat that's sold in the grocery store that people are feeding at home, we have a lot of concerns about the pathogenic bacteria that are present. And the four that we're mostly concerned about, of course, are Salmonella, E. coli, Listeria, and Campylobacter. Those are the four baddies. Those are the ones that cause a lot of sickness, food poisoning in ourselves. A lot of us have experienced that. You might not know exactly what bug that was that made you sick, but we're all very familiar with that.
How often does that happen, though? Is that common that it happens in raw diets, or is it
It's
a real
common
problem?
in people. There is data on the USDA website that has information for all of those different bacteria and the numbers of hospitalizations and deaths every year that happen from those food poisoning events. And as far as pets go and their exposure to those pathogens, there are recalls regularly for commercial raw diets. There are lots of reports of illnesses. Lots of veterinarians have treated those illnesses. We also know that those dogs, even if they don't become sick themselves, they're passing those pathogens in their feces. And there's a growing body of literature documenting that those pathogens are increasingly antibiotic resistant. And that's a huge concern for us as veterinarians and in terms of our interaction with public health and the fact that we need to have antibiotics as an important tool for human illness.
So if you have someone who's immunocompromised at home and they're feeding a raw diet to their dog, they could actually wind up giving themselves a resistant bacterial infection.
Absolutely. And there have been lots of documented illnesses and even death in people that have been exposed to raw diets or the pets that are eating those raw diets.
Now let's say, obviously I'm somewhat aware of this, and I know that our hospital will not feed raw in the hospital because we're concerned about getting a bacterial, contamination in our hospital that's permanent. So we cannot hospitalize a dog who's on a raw diet now because of the risk. But where do we, draw the line? What if we freeze dry it? I know some places will freeze dry raw, or I've had a client tell me that they buy the raw diet and then they cook it.
Yeah, there are lots of mechanisms that people are trying to establish to make raw diet safer. So freeze drying is one way to do that. And freeze drying is a way to preserve some types of bacteria. And it will stop the active reproduction of the bacteria that are there, but it's not going to result in a sterile diet. We still don't have a pathogen kill step necessarily. And there have been recalls of freeze-dried raw diets. And a lot of treats are actually raw, freeze-dried treats, and owners don't realize that they're raw. And it can be difficult to find that information. I have spent a lot of time calling manufacturers trying to find that out. There's also a method called HPP, which can stand for high pressure pasteurization or high pressure processing. That's the same process that human food undergoes. Like if you buy the cooked pulled pork that are in those like sealed plastic containers or sliced cheese that's on a tray covered in plastic, that same process is
It's
subjected to
used
our
there.
food. And so that's been used for raw diets as well. But there are some pressure-resistant Salmonella species. Some diets that have been subjected to that processing method still have been recalled for pathogenic bacteria contamination. So, does that mean that they're getting contaminated after that step? Does that mean that pet food is not a great matrix for that technology? Are there pressure-resistant organisms? There's still a lot to be worked out. There is some progress in that area, though. So hopefully we can increase the safety of those foods going forward. I don't see that segment of pet food going away.
Yeah, what about the grain-free craze, another fad that we've seen? I know that I've seen a lot of over the last few years, especially as an oncologist. There's this idea that a low carbohydrate diet may be better for cancer. So enlighten me again, please.
Yeah, grain-free is a marketing category that's been quite popular in pet foods, and we've been feeding grain-free diets for decades.
Wait, so you're calling it a marketing category here?
Absolutely. There is no nutritional or medical indication for a grain-free diet.
Okay.
And so, what I mean by that is, we have used those diets for a long, long time. They happen to be grain-free. So, for example, there are veterinary therapeutic diets that maybe use potato or pea or something like that with an uncommon protein source like duck, venison, rabbit, etc.
I had to feed one of my previous dogs, who's no longer with us. I had to feed her fish and potato because she had a really bad skin allergy.
Right. And the reason why those diets were developed was because the goal was to try to find a limited combination of ingredients that wasn't very common in the over-the-counter categories that people could just buy at pet stores or grocery stores.
Something they hadn't seen before that they're not going to be allergic to.
Right,
Yeah.
right. So it was supposed to be for GI allergies or skin allergies.
Okay.
Now,
I bring you back to grain free. Okay,
so
yes.
we have all of those ingredients available over the counter now. Grain-free became very popular about 15 or 20 years ago, probably. And again, it's just a marketing category. And so essentially, what they did was they replaced the grains in the diet. And grains are just cereal plants, right? So wheat, corn, rice, barley, oats, etc. They eliminated all of those and essentially replaced that ingredient with tubers, so sweet or white potatoes, usually, or with legumes pulses, so lentils, chickpeas.
Peas.
Green
Yeah,
peas,
green peas.
those kinds of ingredients. And so those diets are not necessarily lower in carbohydrate. They just replace grains with something else.
So it's not carbohydrate free, it's just grain free.
Correct.
So why did we get this idea that grains were bad?
It's very easy for marketing to demonize certain ingredients. In fact, you don't even have to say that an ingredient is bad. All you have to say is no potato. And then, of course, a consumer's response is, well, potatoes must be bad then. It's not that hard. So you're trying to differentiate your product from somebody else's product. And corn was the first scapegoat. So everybody
Of
wanted to
course.
avoid corn, even though corn provides lots of important nutrients. It's very uncommon to have an allergy to corn, etc. The sort of agricultural economics aspect of that is a whole other thing. But from a nutritional perspective, there's nothing wrong with grains.
So I know these all formulated out fine. They went through feeding trials fine. Some of them were made by big manufacturers for a while. What was the problem with grain free? What's the cautionary tale here?
So I think that the problem was that we were suddenly using novel ingredients that weren't very common in the marketplace. So except for soy, most of the beans, peas, other legumes hadn't been really used in pet food that commonly. And then not only did we introduce them to the marketplace, we introduced them in high amounts. Now, some legumes, so lentils, peas, etc., soy,
All the
they
things I love to eat.
Yes, they have anti-nutritional factors as just
Oh.
part of their natural composition. Plants make 99.9% of the pesticides on Earth, and they are protection from being eaten by herbivores, right? That's what
Yeah,
plants do.
that makes
It's
sense.
natural. And so anti-nutritional factors are part of the natural defense system of the plant or the natural sort of structure of the plant cells. And those things can bind up certain nutrients to make them not available. We've known this for a really long time. But what that means is that those ingredients have to undergo processing steps to destroy those anti-nutritional factors and make sure that they are available to whatever animal you happen to be feeding. And so a lot of the diets that were grain-free, we started linking them to a specific type of heart disease in dogs, referred to as DCM or dilated cardiomyopathy.
Pretty serious. Could be that's a life-threatening disease.
Yeah, it's very difficult to find that disease early. And so a lot of these dogs weren't diagnosed until they were critically ill, or some of them
Basically in heart
dropped
failure.
dead, and then were it was found, post-mortem that that's the disease that they had. And this is not a new disease for dogs. It is a genetic disease in certain breeds. And it's a very well-defined clinical entity that our cardiology colleagues have been dealing with for a long period of time. Now, the kind of DCM that we were seeing in these dogs, we think was related to sulfur amino acid status. Now, amino acids, of course, are the building blocks of proteins. There are certain sulfur amino acids that are really important for normal cardiac function.
Yeah, part of these before. I'm sure a lot of people have. So yes. So
yeah, and legumes tend to be low in those. Legumes tend to be low in those. So not only do they have these anti-nutritional factors, they also are low in those specific building blocks.
So like taurine is the name of one of them, right?
Yes.
And so you're not only are you low in taurine for a good portion of your ingredients.
Yes. So taurine is made from the compounds that are in the legumes. So a dog can make enough. They just have to be able to make enough to meet their needs. And so if there's a limited amount of the precursors and we have a lot of fiber coming from those ingredients as well, then eventually the dog's going to become depleted in those. So this is a problem that we have been trying to figure out what exactly is going on mechanistically. It's probably multifactorial. There have been some people that have doubted it's related to food at all. But one of the important factors about this disease when it's diet associated is that it can be reversible. That is not what we see with genetic DCM. It is not reversible.
So now I know as a clinician that I test a dog who's on a grain-free diet for taurine. I sent it to your lab, actually.
Yes. Yeah. And not all dogs that have DCM now are deficient in taurine. And partly that's because a lot of the diets have been supplemented with taurine. And so it really masks our ability to assess the dog's ability to make taurine if you're giving the sort of end compound in that pathway. So still a bit of a mystery. But since grain-free diets are not medically or nutritionally indicated, I think that there's no reason to choose that kind of diet.
So now we were talking about who regulates this stuff. So this is FDA. So did the FDA get involved? Did they pull these dog foods off the shelves?
Yeah, the FDA was getting a lot of reports through the portal, the pet food complaint reporting portal, and they investigated it and they released a couple of different reports a few different times describing the different diets, the features of the diets and so forth. But because this is such a complex phenomenon and so many different diets were involved, and that said, a lot of the diets that were involved in most of the cases were fed to a very small number of dogs in general. And so compared to their market share, the number of cases that they were seeing was fairly suspicious that it was diet related. But we were never able to identify exactly what the problem was. And so there's never going to be a recall for a diet or a category of diets when we can't identify exactly what the problem is, because we're unable to say these ones are safe and these ones are not.
So we didn't test this batch and find there was contamination with the bacteria like Salmonella or E. coli. We kind of said, well, this is associated, but we can't prove it, so the government wouldn't step in.
Yes, correct. So we're still working on this. There are some groups that are looking at potential toxins that are present in some of these ingredients. My lab is working on markers other than taurine to try to identify early if there might be a problem. So I'm hopeful that we'll identify what exactly is going on so that we can have improved formulation of these products. But we still see this disease with some regularity, not as commonly as we were 5 years ago, but we still see it occasionally.
So now this has been amazing, and I've now gone 20 minutes over past where I was going to talk to you, but I have a couple more questions. Can we go on?
Is that absolutely okay? Love talking about food.
I actually going to step away from food, but I want to ask you about supplements and toppers. So first, supplements, mostly fish oil, I was curious about. I mean, I know that fish oil is good for many things, you know, so should I be giving my dog fish oils?
Fish oil is so popular as a supplement now. And the reason why we use fish oil is because we want to enrich the diet with omega-3 fatty acids. Mm-hmm. So those are the fatty acids that are present in the fatty tissues, mostly of cold water fish. But we do have some really good sources now that come from algae.
Which
is a much better source in terms of environmental sustainability. It's acceptable to vegans, et cetera. So those are really good options.
Yeah, it makes your dog's coat shiny is what the, you know, the at least the lore is.
And if you don't mind your dog having a little bit of fishy breath, that's okay too.
Fishy breath and maybe some other smells coming out on occasion too. But the so what are the downsides? What do we have to watch for? How do I choose a fish oil?
Yeah, fish oil dosing is based on what you're trying to achieve. So the nutrients that are coming from fish oil, those omega-3 fatty acids, those are not considered nutritionally essential in adult dogs. They are considered nutritionally essential probably during growth and development because they're really important for neurological tissue development. Once you become adult, though, they're not strictly considered essential, which is arguable. The fatty acid scientists like to fight about this a lot. But we also use them therapeutically. So we give even higher doses, sort of for their anti-inflammatory effects. And so many diseases have an inflammatory component that we're often using fish oils for everything from kidney disease to cancer to arthritis to heart disease. And we do have some good data to show that administering fish oil in some of those circumstances, and the earlier the better, does have some benefits therapeutically.
Interesting. So now I know if you go into the grocery store, you can get warning on some of your fish that say, pregnant women shouldn't eat this. And we're worried about things like mercury, heavy metals, and like, how do I know that I'm not just concentrating it in a bottle and giving them the fish oils they need, but at the same time poisoning my dog with mercury?
That's a huge concern, of
Yeah,
course.
I'd be concerned. I am concerned. So.
Yeah, it's the processing and purification processes that fish oil undergo are highly variable, but it's a really important part of the manufacturing process. So we typically recommend choosing fish oil products from companies that have a firm like distillation process to make sure that it's purified. We want to make sure that they're testing for things like PCBs, dioxins, mercury, arsenic, etc. I have done a couple of different studies looking at fish oil for pets and have identified at least low levels of things like arsenic, selenium, which can become toxic in high levels. We have found some dioxins in some fish oil as well.
So how do I do they publish this on the label? Is that required, or do I have to go to their website to see if they have tested for these? And do you have to test each batch? How do I, again, getting back to the, I'm
How do I
looking,
do
how do
it?
I do it?
Yeah, fish oil companies or manufacturers that make fish oil are using a natural product. So from batch to batch, there might be some variation. Maybe they're using different species of fish in every batch, or it's a mixed species
Depending on the
of fish.
seasonality of what's available, or yeah.
Absolutely, right. The algal sources, so the algae, those are grown in big tanks. We don't have to worry about the contamination. Those
There's no
are very
mercury sitting in
clean.
the bay where they're growing it because they're not growing it in the bay.
Correct. Yes,
Yeah.
it's clean and sustainable.
Yes.
The labeling isn't necessarily going to tell you about testing and those kinds of things. Some companies do provide links to a certificate of analysis that's a toxin screening sort of mechanism where they're looking for the common toxins, they're verifying the omega-3 fatty acid concentrations and so forth. So, again, just like for pet food, you have to have a lot of trust in your manufacturer. It's important that they're experienced and that they have a good R&D and quality control processes in place.
So I should actually, if I'm going to go buy one at the grocery store, I should go look up that company and make sure that they have an independent lab checking their work because, trust but verify, or, using an old term, right?
Yeah, and
You,
talking to
yeah.
your veterinarian about what they recommend as well.
Okay. That sounds really important. So you mentioned the word toppers earlier. That's, a term I'm not terribly familiar with, even as a veterinarian. What is a topper and what is it used for? What do you mean?
A lot of owners and their pets love toppers. This is a way that we can add some interest and variety to the daily diet. And
So what's a topper?
well, just like we were talking about before, we can use things like table foods or treats. Some companies make kibble gravy or other kinds of liquids that you can put on top of your dog's balanced diet.
So these are
And
like
so,
flavor enhancers
yeah,
or
it's
make it more interesting.
anything that you add to the main diet. So that could be applesauce, that could be canned pumpkin. We use things like honey and syrup quite regularly when we especially need to restrict fat or protein, then we can
Okay.
leverage sort of the sweet tooth that some dogs have. But like I said, there's also specific products that are marketed as toppers that you can use. I'm always a big fan of using table foods instead of commercial treats as snacks, though.
So this is where if I wanted to give my dog some of my dinner, I could actually cut it up, put it on his bowl of food, and make his food more interesting and make me feel better that I'm not home cooking for him.
Yeah, and they love it, right? And we'd like to see our pets enjoying their diet,
Food
right?
does equal love sometimes,
It
right?
does.
You know,
It
or we at
does.
least express it that way,
It's
you
very
know.
culturally important to us, and it's important to our pets too. And so the important rule for that, again, we talked about the treat allowance and our 10% rule.
Is that calories or volume?
That is percent of calories. So that's a little difficult to quantify. And
Yeah.
it's much easier to stay below that 10% rule if you're using things like vegetables and fruits versus using things like cream cheese, peanut butter, meat that adds up really fast because they have more calories.
That makes sense. And as we think about calories, I know one of the problems we have, especially in our older dogs, when, you know, they may slow down a little bit, same as people, it's hard to keep that weight off. And you're actually even losing your muscle mass as you get older, and you're adding weight. It's harder on your joints. It's harder for orthopedics, other diseases, metabolic disease. How do we keep track of this? And we get the older dog who's starting to put on pounds. How do we think about this? How do we approach this?
Prevention is much better than trying to reverse an overweight condition once it occurs. And so, having an owner proactively assess their pet on some kind of regular basis, and sometimes I recommend that people, maybe that are giving a monthly heartworm preventative or something like that, they sort of use that as their trigger in their brain. I should assess my dog's body weight and body condition because changes happen slowly, day by day, and we don't notice them. And then one day you look at your dog and you're like, oh my God, your head is so small. It's actually that they've
Yes,
gained weight,
and it
right?
didn't shrink.
Right.
Yes.
And so just sort of doing that proactively and reminding yourself to assess them and then make adjustments as needed. If there haven't been any changes in the diet and you don't think that there's sabotaging their own diet by stealing things or somebody's not feeding them extra things, it might be worth talking to your veterinarian about any significant changes that you notice. If your pet suddenly develops a big belly or suddenly loses a lot of muscle mass or becomes less active pretty abruptly or something like that,
I
it's
mean,
important to get that checked out.
those are all signs of disease too,
Yes.
right? You know, rapid changes.
Yes.
So I've now totally blown talking to you for a half hour because we're gonna have to split this one in two now because we're past an hour. So, but something I've noticed and something that, you know, is we get some training in veterinary school about nutrition, but probably nowhere near enough. And I know owners come to their vets to ask them about nutritional questions. Where do you think the state of nutritional education is so that our veterinarians who are helping everyone out in the real world, not just in the ivory tower of the university here, have access to it? I have access to you. I ask you all the time for questions about my patients. So I'm having trouble formulating this question right, but what are the resources out there for people? How do they find out more information, and how do we do a better job of educating the public?
I think that's an excellent question. One of my favorite parts of my job is working with veterinarians that are out in the trenches. And I do that through formal consulting through online websites with other veterinarians. We get phone calls and emails from veterinarians all the time. And sometimes they have a really complex, diseased patient that needs pretty high-level interventions. And other times they have questions about a specific brand or a specific marketing strategy. And one thing I'm almost always reminding them of is you know more than you think you do. I think that veterinarians are people, and they're just as confused about some of the pet food marketing as pet owners are. And
Fair.
so I'm always reminding them that's just marketing. That doesn't mean anything nutritionally. And I think that's very reassuring to them. And even if they did not get formal, separate courses specifically in nutrition in veterinary school. Nutrition is so fundamental to the management of so many diseases that it's integrated into medicine courses, oncology courses, dermatology courses, etc. So they actually get a lot of nutrition. It's just not taught in some schools as a separate discipline. Rather, it's more integrated.
So you feel like going to your veterinarian, you should be able to ask your veterinarian about nutrition. And if you ask a question they don't know, they should be able to reach out to a colleague who does.
Absolutely. And I really hope that veterinarians are asking about diet history, that they are looking at body condition and body weights and recording that in records.
Body condition. What do you mean by body condition?
That's an assessment of how much fat tissue a pet has. So fat tissue is normal and healthy. You should have a certain amount. But if you start accumulating too much, then we start giving you a higher numerical score on our body condition score system. So it's just a way of us sort of assessing whether a dog is overweight, perfect, or underweight for their individual frame. And I really want veterinarians to feel confident making those assessments and putting those in the record. But a lot of times we sort of, I think probably getting away with is not the right answer, but because we have so many good commercial options that supply nutritional needs of pets, we're not seeing diseases that we used to see that often anymore. So things like rickets, other kinds of deficiencies, we still see those on with some regularity, but not like we used to. And so we've done such a good job in meeting the nutritional needs of most of the pets that are out there that now it's sort of the pendulum's swinging the other way where we've sort of almost forgotten about it.
Wow. This is, you know, obviously this is such a big topic that we're talking about and so important and fundamental for our dog's health. And I realize I've now spoken to you for an hour and I haven't started asking about cats. Going to have to ask you to come back and we could do a cat episode.
I would love to come back and talk about cats.
Good, because I have two cats and now I'm going to tell you I'm standing in the grocery store aisle looking for a cat food and what do we do? So Dr. Larson, I appreciate you taking the time today and sharing your knowledge and expertise with me and with everyone who's listening to us.
Thank you for having me. I can't wait to come back.
Thank you. Okay, bye.
The Vetrospective, as with life, takes a village. I want to thank those who suggested I start this project and everyone who has encouraged and supported me along the way. Particularly, I want to thank our producer and director, Danae Blythe-Unti, Nancy Bay, who is our program coordinator, our sound mixer, Andy Cowett, and theme music was composed and produced by Tim Gehagen. Thank you all, and we'll see you next time.